Happy last days of March 2026, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm your host, Roxana, and today I have Ken Lane's newest episode for you from March 27th, 2026. First up, we have Meteor Nights on the Road to Graceland.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. When the mystery returns. I was glancing at the news and saw this great big house I instantly recognized. Elvis Presley's Graceland. Because the president visited Graceland along with all the news media the other day. It really is a place of pilgrimage, especially for those who know a little about show business. It's even a National Historic Landmark. But since 2006, when then-President George W. Bush visited. Jimmy Carter visited too, but after he was president. Elvis died when Jimmy Carter was president. 6 months after Carter's inauguration, now that I think about it. We gotta look into that. Now, Elvis famously visited Richard Nixon at the White House in the early 70s. But Nixon gave Elvis a license to kill, a DEA agent's badge. This is true. Many rooms in the mansion. And Bill Clinton earned the Secret Service code name Elvis. Nobody knows why. Not for a saying. So there's the famed mansion, Graceland, on the front page, front screen of the computer-generated news headlines. Some 66 years since Elvis moved into his beloved home. 13-plus acres along U.S. Route 51, the section in front of Graceland, since renamed Elvis Presley Boulevard. If you were ever kind of a music nut about hillbilly and rockabilly, country western and western swing, well, you know about Graceland because you know about rock and roll, the primal force that rose up out of Mississippi poverty and poetry. Even people who don't like Southern music tend to know about Graceland because Elvis Presley was the biggest star in America, the biggest sensation in the world for many years. The guy from Simon and Garfunkel even made a pop record called Graceland. And it was a big deal about 40 years ago, which was already 30 years after Elvis Presley's first record, which was a double A-side single, That's All Right Mama and Blue Moon of Kentucky, Blues and Bluegrass together at last. So if that was 70-plus years ago, Elvis would be 91 years old in our time, the year of our Lord, 2026. He'd be 4 years younger than the alive and well William Shatner. So it's not impossible to imagine. Bob Dylan's in his early 80s, still on the road, still making records to great acclaim. Had a big movie made about him. So maybe Elvis is still out there. The great Elvis Presley. Maybe listening on his radio tonight, pulled over on the side of Amboy Road. Like way back when Elvis would head up to Vegas to do his shows. But Elvis Presley, if you're out there, I've done you proper reverence. I am accredited vocalist on Mojo Nixon's song, Elvis is Everywhere, no lie. So we're not putting you down. Presley would head up from Palm Springs because he and his wife Priscilla, Mrs. Presley, had a home there. They called it Graceland West. It was on West Chino Road in Palm Springs. There's even a story about Elvis seeing a great big triangular UFO hovering low over the Mojave on the side of the road during one of those very drives to Vegas. I've told it before. I used to always tell that story at the Desert Oracle campfire stories in Palm Springs. How the pattern of lights he saw to Elvis looked like Joseph Stalin.
Desert Oracle Radio.
But Elvis's real home was Graceland, a stately colonial revival mansion with four Corinthian columns supporting a Greek temple-style portico that reaches out to greet you. The house is built on a little hill over an ancient grove of oaks and pleasant green pastures. It was already called Graceland when Elvis's parents bought the house for him. Being sent out with $100,000 and Elvis's requirements for the place, he wanted space around because the never-ending fans coming around had driven his previous neighbors nuts in a rich neighborhood on Audubon Drive in Memphis. Graceland was not a farmhouse, which is what Elvis asked his parents to find. But he liked it, this stately home. Built by the old Tennessee gentry. He moved in way back in 1957. Just a couple of years into his whirlwind career. By the 1960s, when Elvis had been released by the Army, which took him for 2 years, sent him to Germany, where he sat around on a U.S. Army base and played guitar and chased the daughters of the commanding officers. By the 60s, when he was home, Elvis started decorating Graceland to fit his whims and to fit the excesses of 1960s interior design. The house itself is beautiful. It could be the home of a founding father. And it is, in a way. But inside is what most people remember, especially since tacky strip mall Memphis filled in all the pretty rural land that had once been around the Presley's acreage. It should be like Monticello approached through farmland. On horseback, ideally. I know the place. Graceland. I've been there. I went there in the middle 1980s on a road trip through Tennessee from Memphis to Bristol, hitting all the holy pilgrimage stops on the country music tour. I had an F-150 with a straight six, the rare stick-on-the-floor model. I was like a manual transmission. I like the coordination of the left foot on the clutch and the right hand shifting gears, right foot on the gas, left hand on the wheel, engaged driving. That was a good truck. That was a XLT, dark gray with light gray panels. I put in a custom stereo on the cassette deck. It had a 40-channel Cobra CB radio. I added a camper shell so you could sleep a couple hours at the rest stop. And then power on through the American night. Elvis had only been gone 7 years or so when I walked into Graceland. You could walk up to his private jet, the Lisa Marie, named for his daughter. And his pink Cadillac was parked under a carport behind the house. I've got a picture of me standing in front of it at the driver's side door. I probably could have sat on the hood if I wanted, but that would be barbaric. Like knocking over the altar with the sacrament in church. Elvis's famous guitar was open in the case. Elvis Presley spelled out on the fretboard. A gimmick that Jimmy Rogers started nearly a century ago in 1928. Fret comes from Old French. In the 1300s, the 14th century, it meant a binding or lacing. I remember the billiards room that Elvis had very well. It was like the inside of some Hollywood sultan's tent. It was too busy for my taste then and now. The kitchen and other technology-heavy rooms already felt outdated, garish. Taste changed real quick in the 1980s. It was sort of all reactionary. Like so much is. In personal taste and otherwise. In Nashville, we made respectful visits to the Country Music Hall of Fame and the Ryman Auditorium, went to Music Row, went to RCA Studio B, built by Chet Atkins. Home studio to all kinds of legends. Roy Orbison, Dolly Parton, the Everly Brothers, Porter Wagoner. 240 Elvis Presley songs were recorded there, including Are You Lonesome Tonight? And Now and Then There's a Fool Such as I. It's been a museum since 1977, but in the mid-80s, it was still very hands-on. A little different than now. There were guitars set up, old tube amps on, an Echoplex reverb unit plugged into a blonde Fender amp, and you could play around with the instruments. The guys watching the studio were retired engineers and retired pickers. They wouldn't let you mess anything up, but they didn't mind if you played a couple of chords on the piano Floyd Kramer played on all those great records. That's where he played his famous instrumental, Last Date. Pull that up on your stereo music app someday. That's one of the most evocative pieces of music in the American canon. Never used in a David Lynch movie that I know of. Though David Lynch sure used Roy Orbison's In Dreams, on which Floyd Kramer's playing the piano, Boots Randolph on saxophone, the guitar greats Howard Bradley and Grady Martin, also recorded in RCA Studio B, Nashville, Tennessee. Harold Bradley was Owen Bradley's little brother, Owen Bradley, who famously produced Patsy Cline's famous records. Harold Bradley's probably the most popular musician few people know the name of. He played on thousands of hits, pop and rock, and especially country. Because he recorded in Owen Bradley's famous Nashville Sound Studio, which is known for the smooth and sophisticated stuff. But that's also Harold Bradley picking Dixie on the banjo leading into Johnny Horton's The Battle of New Orleans. And the slinky six-string electric bass on Patsy Cline's Crazy. He's playing guitar on Jingle Bell Rock and Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree by Miss Brenda Lee. Anyway, I'm glad to see Graceland is still the shrine it should be when you make it to president, which is about as close to being Elvis as a mortal can get. You should visit the tomb of Elvis behind the famous mansion. Like Alexander the Great visited the famous tomb of Achilles outside Troy 2,350 years ago. He paid homage at the tombs of Ajax and all the rest, according to 1st century AD historian Diodorus. But at the tomb of Achilles, Alexander performed a euphoric ritual, tearing off his clothes and dancing naked around the tomb of the Trojan war hero. This according to Plutarch and his Parallel Lives. And Plutarch has the greatest respect for Alexander, and as a high priest of the Temple of Apollo at Delphi, he has the greatest respect for Achilles, legendary demigod and hero, and famously bad-tempered, too. But Achilles came around. Those romantic young boys, all they want to do is fight. Well, that's a Bruce Springsteen line from back in his Van Morrison phase. Bruce Springsteen got in trouble once for trying to jump the fence at Graceland. He wanted to get in and talk to the king. Another long hair out of his mind on something or other. What graves are we wantonly dancing around in our time? A couple of decades ago, I saw some kind of grunge hippies dancing around Jim Morrison's tomb in Paris. They weren't naked, though. That's probably for the best. But what about the meteors? Well, I don't know if you've heard or seen, but we've been getting a lot of meteors and great big fireballs, especially over America in the past week or so. And with the warfare happening in the Middle East, and stories of long-range missiles, like the ones that got nearly to Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, we're all a little edgy about strange things falling out of the sky. Especially when the astronomers keep insisting that this is not a meteor storm. But we're in the middle of something which is a rash of widely seen fireballs and meteors, notable ones every day now. If you follow the NASA Skywatch alerts, well, they're not quite alerts because they come out after the sightings are reported, but you can see all the reports coming in. And sometimes even some pictures, some dash cam videos, some doorbell surveillance videos. A hunk of space rock pierced a Houston house's roof and was poking through the ceiling drywall. People are bringing in strange samples from cow pastures. What's going on? Well, here's the truth. Some valuable information you can use in your life. Tell your friends, impress your enemies. From Joshua Tree's community radio station, Z107.7 FM. In March, often every March, there are many dramatic fireball sightings. Astronomers expect it. Sky watchers look forward to it. Lots of dramatic sightings. East Coast, West Coast, Midwest, Mountain West, all over the place. My favorites are the green fireballs. If you haven't heard it, go back into our archives and look for the Mysterious Green Fireballs episode from, oh, probably 5 or 6 years ago. Longer. Something like 20 meteorites hit the Earth's surface every day. About 7,000 of them every year. And these are the ones that hit, that leave some space rock behind. Because the Earth is mostly covered in oceans, most of those space rocks just plop into the wide dark sea, and that's it. Maybe now and then one hits a fish. But it adds up, all those little rocks and occasional big rocks. It adds up to about 50 tons of space dust and bits of rock that make it to the surface each and every day. 50 tons. That would cost you about $3,000 to dump at the landfill, and landers let the fish have it. Most of the shooting stars we see are little bits of rock and ore that burn up in the atmosphere. And that's what we see. This bit of rock is hauling tail through the solar system. It's going somewhere between 25,000 and 100,000 miles per hour. And then they hit the wall, the barrier, the defense system of Earth, in place for nearly 3 billion years now. There's nothing like it in the solar system. Nothing like it anywhere, as far as we can tell. There is one planet our astronomers have detected using the latest space telescopes, radio telescopes, etc. And if we ever had light-speed space transport, it would still take 125 years to get there, take a look around. See if maybe there were some early simple forms of marine life in the water, if they've got liquid water. So say we could fit a person in the Voyager space probe. Voyagers 1 and 2, the fastest moving spacecraft out there. Well, it would still take around 100,000 years to get to this planet. Check it out. We're going to need more than one person to fit in there, a minimum of two. 100,000 years. What a remarkable combination of circumstances, pieces in motion over billions of years that made our home planet, planet Earth, that rarest of places. The thick atmosphere saves Earth from looking like the moon or Mars, covered in craters, one disaster after another. Not pummeled by rocks, not burnt up by the sun's radiation, is it luck? Amboy to Zyzix and across the great Mojave Wilderness. You've been listening to Desert Oracle Radio. We broadcast Friday nights at 10 p.m. on KCDZ 107.7 FM, community radio in the high desert. Or listen to our podcast. Thanks to all our friends on patreon.com/Desert Oracle who support this show, which you'll notice does not have any annoying commercials. That's a choice. And we had some classic red, blue, black, silver soundscapes on tonight's program. The magnetosphere keeps our atmosphere in place. It keeps it from being destroyed by the constant barrage of solar radiation. The sun is life, but as we know very well out here in the desert, if not deflected, limited, if we don't get some protection from it, the sun is also death. Everything is death, or without life. Except for here on our beautiful planet. Why is that? Even the most pragmatic of scientists are baffled to the point that one of them, the late Carl Sagan, invented a way to think about creation becoming conscious through us. Humanity becomes the means by which the universe comes to know itself. Well, maybe. The discoveries come with great telescopes, great vessels from sailing ships to rocket ships, incredible propulsion systems, complex radios that can reach 16 billion miles across space, across time. Like the Voyager probes, still sending data back. The JPL in California, still picking up the signal at the Deep Space Telescope just south of Death Valley National Park. The antenna base and the remote settlement called Mars, and it looks like Mars out there too. Death Valley is kind of known for that. Thank you for listening. Don't get burned up by the sun. And good night from the voice of the desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, and streaming at kgvm.org. This next one was also created by Ken Lane in the times leading up to Easter weekend, just so you know. This was produced April 10th, 2020. Here is Never the Twain Shall Meet.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. And I have been having a lot of interesting dreams. How about you? Now, way back on March 17th, that magical St. Patrick's Day without the mobs of amateurs puking green beer in the streets, I posted something because the time seemed ripe for it. If you have a notebook or diary gathering dust and don't have to wake to an alarm right now, try writing down whatever dreams you can remember as soon as you wake up. It's astounding how much is going on up there and how much of it we usually forget. Nearly a month on, the reports are in. People are having a lot of intense dreams. Now, you know how much I think about the mysterious and the divine, how it barges into the lives of even the most basic people now and again? But before we go down that road, I'd like to offer a prosaic reason why many of us are remembering our dreams right now, and here I am speaking exclusively of the housebound, those who don't work in any sort of essential job, or maybe weren't working before all this, whether due to retirement or disability or unemployment, or maybe even because they're rich as Midas and don't have to work. When you don't wake to an alarm, you tend to remember more of your dreams. When you don't need to bolt out of bed and run to the day's mundane task and the time clock and the commute and the calendar on your computer that does your thinking for you, you have a moment to reflect, to ponder, to run through some things in your head. People who are afraid to be alone with their thoughts, I've found, usually don't have many thoughts to start with. So, if you were there in bed, even if the alarm went off, but you don't really have to leave, and you can afford a few minutes to wake up slowly, then you will probably remember at least a few flickers from the dreams you had, especially the dreams closest to the time you awoke. This is why I keep a dream journal close at hand, so when I awake and I can scribble down whatever I remember, it's still fresh in my head before it's lost to the waking life. The waking life just eats up the rich world of your dream life. It eats it up and it spits it out, and there's nothing you can recognize after that. It's just gone. So write down your dreams. If nightmares plague you, a true fact is that writing them down can weaken their ability to scare you. There's something about finding the words to describe some faceless monster chasing you up the stairs with a boat paddle, a frozen turkey, that really replaces the horror with absurdity. And then maybe when that sort of dream occurs again, you are more prepared. You might even be able to switch on the lucid dreaming and recognize the stupidity and ridiculous nature of the events within the dream itself. And that's always fun, because once you're lucid, then you also know there's nothing that can hurt you in a dream. It may be a vision or a prophecy, or it may be a mishmash of workaday anxieties and the half-baked plot of a stupid Netflix show you fell asleep watching the night before. Well, if you allow a filthy TV screen in your bedchamber, which you should not, that may happen a lot, the recycling of the entertainment. So leave that thing in the other room if you can. Don't open up your sleeping self to the for-profit garbage generated by an industry. They do not have your best interest in mind. So my assumption here, based on my own experience and the experiences of many others who have reported on their dreams, is that having a few extra moments to reflect when you wake is what gives you the space to remember the dreams you just had. just before waking, at least. That's why we think we're having more dreams right now. We've got a little more headspace, those of us who are under lockdown, and that's most of the world now. Again, except for the essential workers doing the essential work at great risk to themselves and generally with no choice in the matter. But even the exhausted can recall their dreams, especially if the dreams awaken them in the night. So write down your dreams. Write as much as you can remember as quickly as you can. As soon as you start trying to make sense of it, start trying to create transitions where none existed, create order out of the dream world chaos, you lose it. So write quickly. Stop when you don't remember anymore. Don't make anything up. Don't assign identities to the characters unless it was immediately apparent, either within the dream itself or immediately upon recalling it. Later, once it's written, you can reflect upon what it meant, spin some theories, think about if maybe you can get a Netflix series of your own from that weird dream about a bull elk with Jimmy Kimmel's mouth that was following you through an empty airport terminal while an old advertising jingle played softly over the PA system. Maybe even you can get Jimmy Kimmel involved. Get him to be executive producer. Dreams can and should be watched for waking world significance. Sometimes, as they say, a hat is just a hat. Plus, what kind of modern hat would you possibly apply to the old Freudian obsessions? What would a hoodie mean to Freud? Impotence? Lack of identity? Sometimes a mask is just a mask. And sometimes it's just whatever you use as a plague mask. But other times... other times, dreams are windows to the soul, windows through which the gods of time and fate and inspiration and longing and doom speak to us, through us. Dreams can be individualized messages or beacons or directions, but they can and often are something like a Zoom meeting, what everybody's thinking, what everybody fears. The Austrian philosopher and psychiatrist Carl Jung broke with Freud in 1913. Over Freud's insistence that the whole of human consciousness was little more than the torrents of sexual repression and other dull desires. Creating the new field of analytical psychology to address the much deeper mysteries of human consciousness, Dr. Jung listened to his patients' dream recollections not just as personal and biological turmoil, but as evidence of connections to a wireless data stream that connects all of humanity, all of biological life. And within these streams of ancient and modern information, he began to note many dreamers' uncanny glimpses of the future. The absolute horrors many of his Austrian and German patients reported in their dreams that began taking form as real events, real horror. And the mass executions and genocide of the Third Reich. Images and scenes that seemed too awful to intrude upon the waking life of seemingly modern Western civilization were in fact real scenes from the Holocaust to come. Scenes that would not truly be understood until after Hitler's defeat, after the destruction of the Nazis and the liberation of the death camp survivors, and the hideous testimony from the Nuremberg trials. Jung's patients were the elite of modern society. They were wealthy or at least comfortable. Psychotherapy was all the rage in the 20s and 30s with the fashionable and well-heeled crowds. Intellectualism was very much in as opposed to the embrace of the idiotic in our own time. What Jung and Freud were allowing this new modern human to do was to pick apart their own minds, the same way they picked apart modern architecture and literature and music and the sciences. Having mostly lost their faith in the old gods, they sought permission to be their own gods. And once given this permission, they really performed the analytics themselves. Well, that's why the gruesome news flashes from the near future were so disturbing. There was nothing really to explain them yet. Still, many of these dreams were literal. The screaming, starving humans pushed into death chambers were not stand-ins for some trouble in the individual psyche. But such portals to future events are rare, especially rare in such numbers. Jung's dreamers of the Third Reich were from the respectable trades, mostly. Accountants and medical doctors, secretaries and school teachers, and minor nobles who danced at Habsburg balls. Chemists and biologists, academics of all sorts. It was shocking and strange that these people, far from mystic, would perceive the future with such hard and awful clarity. More often, the dreams and visions and mass experiences that foretell the future, possible futures at least, are far more strange, far more difficult to interpret. This, I believe, explains at least some of the mass UFO sightings across the American Great Plains between early December 20 and 19 and mid-January 20 and 20. For roughly 6 weeks, beginning in the rural northeastern corner of Colorado and spreading in various and unpredictable directions through Kansas towards New Mexico, and across Nebraska and Iowa, and northwest into Wyoming, many thousands of ordinary people witnessed extraordinary things in the sky that made no sense. You may have heard about these events in the major newspapers, from the Denver Post to the New York Times. You may have seen reports on cable news or the Facebook groups that sprung up across the Great Plains where people could discuss these odd visions with friends and neighbors. Witnesses included pilots, sheriff's deputies, truck drivers, farmers, hunters, children, the elderly, churchgoers, scientists, soldiers. Rare, but not unheard of for such mass sightings. What J. Allen Hynek called UFO flaps. Reporters and photographers witnessed a strange activity in the sky, too. The initial reports covering a dozen sparsely populated Colorado counties involved rows of low-flying blobs of multicolored lights. Sometimes estimated as about 6 feet across, usually silent, and rarely more than 300 feet above the fields and plains and interstates. These mystery craft followed invisible grid lines, sometimes miles wide, sometimes with a dozen or more craft moving in alignment, as if tracing a map of the Earth. Surveying for something. Because the word drone, usually describing a small battery-powered aircraft flown by remote control, looms large in modern life, People describe these things as drones, mystery drones, as they became known. No matter that small drones cannot fly for hours on end, do not present randomized displays of intense lights, and do not fly without the telltale buzzing sound that has made the cursed toys so hated around the world. A few decades ago, they would have been called UFOs. A few centuries ago, they would have been called wonders in the sky, or angels, or witches flying on broomsticks. Just as the mass sighting at Fatima, Portugal, a century ago, was called Mary, Mother of God, Queen of the Universe. Which is a strange way to describe a cloudy yet brilliant ball of light in the sky as big as the sun, which then swept out of the clouds and hovered menacingly above the terrified crowd, instantly drying their rain-soaked clothes with blasts of intense heat radiating from this hovering globe. But over the Great Plains, beginning just after Thanksgiving of 2019 and peaking in January of 2020, we threw the word drones at the mystery. Weather cams recorded dozens of odd pulsing lights flying low on the horizon. Many witnesses described what they called a mothership, too. Much bigger and brighter than the lower flying craft. This mothership kept watch. When the smaller craft blinked out, the mothership shot straight up into the night sky, disappearing in a point of light. Not all of the mystery drones flew in robotic grid patterns. Sometimes they shine their powerful spotlights into farmhouses. Sometimes they paced sheriff's deputies driving the back roads and highways. And they had a strange effect on the ground, too. When the drones passed overhead, cell phones and even wired internet connections went dead. In four states, multiple witnesses reported that the bright flashing lights would blink out when people on the ground so much as reached for their cell phones. Nonetheless, photos and video of the Night Stalkers can be found all over the internet, although a little more of it disappears every day. Many of the Facebook groups have gone dark. Witnesses were tired of being berated by griefers or harassed by journalists and UFO fanatics. One sheriff's department after another first encouraged reports and then suddenly shut down those efforts. The Federal Transportation Department secretary, who happens to be Mitch McConnell's wife, went on the record as saying the mystery craft were unknown and unsolved. The FAA and the military bases of the Great Plains and Intermountain West denied any knowledge of the craft, only saying that such flights were likely illegal and completely unauthorized, if the pilots could ever be found, which they were not. Despite thousands of people on the lookout, as Colorado's Department of Public Safety requested in January, nobody ever saw a mobile launch vehicle on the ground from where the mystery drones would have had to have been launched. Nobody ever saw one of the alleged drones take off or land. While many claimed to be ready to shoot the night intruders out of the sky, it never happened. The things were untouchable. And by the middle of February, reports had dropped to a trickle of what they had been in early January. By then, people who rarely glanced up at the night sky were out in numbers, eagerly misidentifying every commonplace thing in the sky as a sinister invader. The planets, commercial aircraft, stars, and especially the SpaceX orbital Starlink satellites that began appearing with regularity just about this time. No matter the difference between orbital lines of pinpoint satellites and low-flying craft shining spotlights into truckers' cabs and bedroom windows. Such things likely have no material world explanations. It is left to the diviners and oracles to attempt to make sense of them. And so, cognizant of my job title in this radio operation, I say these frightening mysteries that began in early December and peaked around New Year's were an omen of what was on the way to America. Maybe, as Jung theorized, these visions are generated by the electrical power of our own minds, our own combined consciousness. A psychic alarm bell, a warning. Get ready, get ready. Who looks outside? Dreams. Who looks inside? Awakes. In all chaos, there is a cosmos. In all disorder, a secret order. Thus spake Carl Jung. Maybe it's an intelligence, foreign or domestic, perhaps unbound by space or time. We cannot know, not yet. I believe it's far less important to know the how of such things than it is to know the why. One day, perhaps, maybe, some researchers will decode a fast radio burst from across the galaxy, and it will tell us to lock down Wuhan completely right now, to get everybody out of those senior death camps in Italy and France and America now, because it's coming, and we do not yet have the code to put it back in its cage. We can keep trying, at least. Meanwhile, what we know is that these omens and portents and signs and wonders in the sky do have meaning. We must pay attention to them. We must try and put two and two together. The earliest scientists were magicians and prophets and priests reading animal guts spilled beneath an altar. Taking what they know and applying it to what might happen, and trying to divine some clues in whatever way they could, they attempted to make sense of the signs. When I started following the mystery drones back in the before times of December, I was following the strange news out of China, too, like a lot of us were. Like a lot of us were, pretty much everywhere except where they were supposed to be watching for such things. And as the hysteria over the Great Plains grew, an unrelated hysteria spread across the great land of China. Oh, east is east, and west is west, and never the twain shall meet. Until they do. Until they did. Until they did in our little global community where the health and wealth of all is the health and wealth of one. You know about inauguration, right? It's when the augurs, the priests and magicians trained to watch the signs of the natural and supernatural, give a verdict as to whether it's a good time to anoint a new king, a new emperor. Especially by watching the flights of the birds, the actions of the birds. Well, we still do it, the inauguration. We still do it here in America in a self-conscious imitation of the old Roman rite. But we forgot to watch for the signs within the flights and actions of the birds. Watch the skies. Not for Hollywood sci-fi licensed characters and basic cable, basic fiction, but for signs importance. Such things may not hold the concrete answers, but they can tell us when the storm is coming. They can tell us to prepare, to watch the horizon, to know that the next big bad thing that's likely to happen is really about to go down. This time, coming soon. From Amboy to Zizix and across the Great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio, and I am your host, Ken Lane. We broadcast from Joshua Tree. We've got a Patreon set up as well. Much appreciate all of you who chip in a bit to keep the operation going out here in the Great American Desert. And we much appreciate you listening to this program during these weird times. And when times are good, too. And times will be good again. Hang in there, buddies. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.
Well, there's our friendly jet again. Well, my thanks to Red, Blue, Black, Silver, and to Ken Lane for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to all the volunteers, supporters, and underwriters that make KGVM so wonderful. Thanks to you for listening. This April will be the 30th year of National Poetry Month. Please share a favorite poem with us. Leave a text or voicemail for me at 406-424-6246, and I will get back to you. This program broadcasts on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are archived for you on the kgvm.org website. Watch those skies. Stay well. Keep doing good things and sweet dreams. I leave you with this thought from Mahatma Gandhi. I want to realize brotherhood or identity, not merely with the beings called human, but I want to realize identity with all life, even with such beings as crawl on earth. I'll see you next week.